loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we'll turn to the ongoing coup efforts by the Trump administration in Venezuela. We'll talk to people from Venezuela. We have a major public relations stunt by the Trump administration that played well in the U.S. mainstream media. The Democratic Party leadership is also coming out in numbers for the coup. We're going to talk about what's going on, though, inside Venezuela. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. 16 civilians were killed today in Syria as they headed for the Iraq border, including 7 children, 8 women, and an elderly man, as the U.S.-led coalition continued their airstrikes on one of the last pockets of insurgents. The coalition was not immediately available for comment, according to the Associated Press. Today is the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, when the people of Iran overthrew the U.S.-backed regime of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, addressed a rally today and denounced U.S. sanctions on the country, saying that they would not break Iran. Estimates of rallies and gatherings across the country range from hundreds of thousands to millions of people, varying across different media. Representative Walter Jones passed away this weekend in Greenville, North Carolina. He was a vocal supporter of the war in Iraq until he regretted his decision so much that he wrote to individual families of those who were killed during their service, asking for forgiveness and making clear his opposition. The congressman wrote more than 12,000 letters to grieving families. He was 76 years old and was first elected to the House in 1995. Senator Amy Klobuchar officially announced over the weekend in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that she is running for president. She joins a field of 5 Democrats already vying for the nomination. Analysts consider Klobuchar to have a more moderate profile than a few of the other candidates who are running, and she's currently the only candidate from the Midwest. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Venezuela. The Trump administration succeeded last week in advancing its overthrow of the Venezuelan government and in controlling the public relations agenda, at least overseas, maybe not inside Venezuela. A false narrative that President Nicolas Maduro blocked a food and aid convoy was all over the mainstream media. Former President Joe Biden jumped on the coup bandwagon to endorse puppet figure Juan Guaido, and the U.S. moved to cripple Citgo, the U.S.-based retail branch of the Venezuelan National Oil Company. We're joined from Merida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson, a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and we're joined from Caracas by Lucas Kerner, an activist and writer also for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul, Lucas, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Let's start first just with what's going on in Venezuela. I was talking to people yesterday who had just gotten back from Venezuela, back to the States here. And what they were telling me was in such contrast with what anyone could possibly imagine if they were getting their news from social media like Twitter. They said, things are calm. There's not chaos. There's not a massive sort of revolution or counter-revolution that feels like it's underway. Just quickly from both of you, is that accurate? Let's start with you, Lucas.
Absolutely. I mean, as we've reported numerous times in other interviews, the situation in Caracas and most of the country continues largely as normal. I mean, with just people going about their daily lives, going to markets, purchasing products, you know, children going to school, et cetera. There really has not been any interruption whatsoever. And, you know, Juan Guaido, you know, remains largely a virtual presence, you know, claiming, you know, reappearing every once in a while to call and remind the armed forces to try to overthrow the government, but seeming to have no capacity whatsoever to make that a reality.
Paul Dobson, let's go to you. Same question.
Yeah, well, I would totally agree with this. It has to be obviously contextualized a little bit. The calm here in Venezuela is never quite that calm. When you're living with hyperinflation, when you're living with certain shortages, problems with public transport and the effects of a five-year recession and U.S. sanctions. Daily life is never quite calm. It's always a little bit difficult. But in terms of how the media are portraying the current political crisis in Venezuela, we've seen very few day-to-day effects or impact, I could say. It's worth pointing out that it's very much in the interests of those who are promoting this sort of attempted coup d'etat and this position against Venezuela to promote the idea that there is a civil war, there is chaos, there are running street battles and so on. And this is just not the reality.
Lucas Kerner, there's been a lot of mainstream media reportage about the efforts by the Maduro government to block a humanitarian convoy. I want to go over that again. There's a picture of a bridge with what appears to be three tractor trailers, the trailer parts that are blocking the bridge. That media image has been all over the media, all over the mainstream media. I think Mike Pompeo circulated it. But then the reports we're getting is that bridge is not even open, nor has it ever been open. Let's just talk about that.
Yeah, I think there's three major facts that the mainstream media just completely ignores, and it's, you know, utterly naked, you know, and rather, you know, sad effort to just to regurgitate the U.S. Washington's line on this, is that, you know, the fact is the bridge, you know, which was finished in 2015 was never open, you know, because it was finished in the context of border issues with smuggling between Venezuela and Colombia, and, you know, basically for a long period of time the Venezuelan government had the entire border shut down, so this bridge has never been in use. Second, you know, it's not the Maduro government that is calling for this aid to, or questioning this U.S. effort to bring in aid. It's actually the United Nations and the Red Cross who have denounced this as, you know, a political effort to effectively instrumentalize humanitarian aid as a means of toppling a government. And then, of course, the third most important fact is the person who is quarterbacking this whole operation, Elliot Abrams, who is Trump's new special envoy to Venezuela, you know, he's on the record having authorized U.S. humanitarian planes to carry weapons to U.S.-backed Contra death squads in Nicaragua. So, I mean, it would be utterly, you know, Maduro would clearly have no survival instinct if he allowed his aid to enter, given these circumstances.
I'm wondering, too, what the non-American reaction is, the international reaction. Are we hearing anything from European countries, for example, or even Asian countries that are in any way supportive of President Maduro or of resistance to U.S. interference?
Yes, I think this is very important to talk about. Where we work at Venezuela Analysis, we did an investigative piece last week, and we concluded that only 25% of the world's governments have actually recognized Juan Guaido, the man who is attempting to carry out a coup d'etat here. Ergo, the 75% of the world is continuing to recognize the elected government of Nicolas Maduro. Now, when you break this down by regions, you can see very clearly around 98% of Africa, 97% of Asia, and something like 99% of the Middle East are all continuing normal diplomatic relations with the Venezuelan government. When you look at the regions of the Americas and Europe, only around 50%, slightly more in Europe, have actually recognized Juan Guaido. So we can clearly see from this sort of data that his claims and the White House claims that the world is with him and the world is turning its back on Nicolas Maduro are quite clearly false.
Paul Dobson and Lucas Kerner are our guests. They're both writers for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Lucas Kerner, where do you think the opposition is going? I was reading a Wall Street Journal article. It was really something. It was on the front page. It was actually the front page of the Wall Street Journal on Friday. And the point of the article is that there was this tiny cabal, Juan Guaido, and I think three other people, four in total, who actually knew that he was about to proclaim himself the president of Venezuela. Of course, I'm talking about Venezuelans, not Mike Pence or Mike Pompeo or John Bolton. They obviously knew. They were working with him. But the article talks about how when he made this announcement on the stage to an anti-government rally, the other people from the opposition started looking at each other and saying, "What? What's going on here?" And they were so upset about this sudden, startling announcement that they actually left the stage. They didn't know what to make of it. It would seem to me to be perhaps the single biggest piece of evidence that this cannot possibly be construed as a democratic act when Juan Guaido, someone who's never been elected, announces with the support of four other Venezuelans that, in fact, he is the interim president of Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, this comes up also in the wake of Henrique Capriles, the former opposition presidential candidate's interview with Miami Herald, in which he also confirmed that they were totally taken by surprise. And in fact, the majority of the opposition parties did not support this self-proclamation by Mr. Guaido. Now, I think that it's important to recognize that the party faction, which is leading this, is the Popular Will Party, which, you know, is arguably among the Venezuela's, you know, hard right opposition, is most closely tied to Washington, with, you know, its leader Leopoldo López, of course, being educated at, you know, prep school in New Jersey and at Harvard, and has very close ties to U.S. elites, and likewise Carlos Becciu, the new charge of affairs for the Guaido quote unquote transition government, as they're calling it, in Washington. So this is the most, you know, closely aligned to Marco Rubio and the hard right of the Republican Party and the neocon foreign policy establishment. But it's also clear that this faction, you know, is very nakedly seeking international intervention, and it associates its legitimacy precisely with that intervention, as opposed to having any kind of, you know, democratic legitimacy of its own born from elections, you know, as Nicolas Maduro, you know, retains as a result of the May 20th presidential elections, which he won over 6.2 million votes. Let's recall that the United States, you know, Juan Guaido, he said last week that he would not rule out authorizing U.S. military force in order to allow the humanitarian aid to enter. Of course, the State Department has distanced itself from that. But nonetheless, I mean, this is a opposition faction that is really, you know, willing to do, you know, as Juan Guaido, I think, just said today or yesterday, if the military does not rise up to remove Nicolas Maduro from power, then other steps could be taken, Guaido indicated, which, you know, may be, you know, authorizing U.S. military force. And the opposition, which clearly does not have the capacity to oust Maduro on its own terms, through popular mobilization or even through the armed forces, they're clearly looking outside the country to the United States for a solution, which will likely be very violent.
That's Lucas Kerner. We're also talking with Paul Dobson. I want to draw our audience's attention to this article because it's the front page of the Wall Street Journal. No one can accuse the Wall Street Journal of being pro-Maduro, right? So that's why I thought the article was important. It's a picture of Juan Guaido speaking that day from that stage. And the headline is, quote, "What the hell is going on?" close quote. "How a small group seized control of Venezuela's opposition. The plan to unseat Nicolas Maduro came together quickly and secretly, taking many within the country's notoriously fractious opposition by surprise." I'm going to read a couple sentences, Paul Dobson, and then again have you to comment, and then we'll go on to some of the other issues related to this attempted coup. Here it is. "What appeared to be a carefully calibrated policy to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was actually a big gamble by a small group of opposition leaders acting on a hastily assembled plan. The strategy marked a coup of sorts, this one within the country's notoriously fractious opposition, which had been locked in debate over whether to negotiate with Mr. Maduro or to take more direct action. When Juan Guaido declared himself Venezuela's interim president on January 23 in front of a crowd of 100,000 people under a broiling sun, some leading opposition figures had no idea he would do so, say people who worked with him. That included a few standing alongside him, a stern look of shock across their faces. Some quietly left the stage." Quote, "What the hell is going on?" close quote. One member of a group of politicians wrote to the others in a WhatsApp chat, "How come we did not know about this?" And then finally, from the Wall Street Journal, "The plan was largely devised by a group of four opposition leaders, two in exile, one under house arrest, and one barred from leaving the country. It came together only in recent weeks as Mr. Maduro prepared to start a second six-year term on January 10th. So here we have it. There's four people in on the coup besides Guaido. One is under house arrest and two are in exile. Paul Dobson, I mean, is there anything more brazen about this coup than this information that's coming out drip, drip, drip? We're now learning these facts.
Well, there's a whole range of elements which maybe with more time we could talk about. But I think it's interesting that the fact that the Washington Post has used the word coup is itself of great interest. And it's just the latest development, I think, from what both myself and a number of colleagues who work in journalism and the press have noticed in the last 2 weeks. And this is that this attempted coup d'etat has essentially become undefendable, even by the most staunch allies of US imperialism. We've even seen, for example, the BBC, the CNN, and other media outlets evolve their, change their tone on this coup d'etat and recognize it for what it is, and start to recognize that there is a huge mass support for the government. Pro-government support is out on the streets as well. And this can only be considered to be a partial victory for truth. Finally, we have the Washington Post calling this what it is, a coup d'etat. And this really unveils the blatant heavy-handedness of the Trump administration. They didn't even attempt to dress this up in constitutional democratic measures, as they did, for example, in Brazil, but rather they just went directly for a power grab. And we've seen this essentially rally the international and Venezuelan factors behind international values such as self-determination, sovereignty, and democracy, which is a very important development over the last 2 weeks.
That's Paul Dobson. We're also speaking with Lucas Kerner. We're speaking to both of them from Venezuela.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Lucas, too. This seems to me like such a slow-motion coup. On the one hand, it's as though the White House didn't put a lot of thought into it other than just trying to recognize a puppet and hope that the wheels turned and Nicolas Maduro would get on a plane and go to Havana. That clearly wasn't what was going to happen, and it's clearly what has not happened. But eventually, if Washington is serious, blood is going to be spilled in the streets. And I'm wondering what the mood is in Venezuela, but especially in Caracas. Are people ready and willing to fight to keep the Americans out and to ensure that Juan Guaido does not become the president of Venezuela? And just logistically, are people armed? Are they able to fight to defend themselves?
Yeah, I think that honestly, this is what is most dangerous and concerning about the present situation, is that Washington has really put the cart before the horse and has, you know, went ahead with recognizing a government that is nowhere closer. I mean, we're over 2 weeks into this, and they were nowhere closer to actually installing this government into power. And there's really a danger here because the Trump administration has staked a lot of political capital on this. And moreover, when we look at economically, these sanctions, so the new oil embargo that has been imposed basically suspends the secondary market for bonds, for Venezuela's state and oil company bonds. And this means that if the government is not toppled soon, then these bondholders stand to lose a lot from their non-payment. So this really leaves us with a closing window for Washington to achieve regime change. And I think that it's not just about Guaido. It's not just about the opposition in Venezuela. This is a larger issue about the credibility of U.S. threats. I would say U.S. blackmail. That if John Bolton wrote 4,000 U.S. troops from Afghanistan to Colombia on a notepad, in a not so subtle way. And Trump also hinted at U.S. military intervention in Venezuela. And these threats appear to be falling flat as they're not, and this is what is dangerous. If the credibility of U.S. military intervention, the U.S. cannot coerce other countries to do its bidding, then there's a real issue if you're, claim to be the empire. Now, with regard to your question, I think that we were in the Bolivar Square in the heart of Caracas yesterday, and it was thousands and thousands of people lining up. I initially thought that they were lining up for some kind of social benefit or something, because often you'll see people lining up for that. But in fact, they were lining up, these long lines going, all the way around the square into the other street, to sign a petition to the government urging the United States to respect Venezuela's sovereignty and not intervene in its internal affairs. And so there really is, 6.2 million people over, nearly a third of the population voted for Nicolas Maduro last year and so actively support the government. And, I would say even a larger, much larger proportion of the population are hostile to U.S. intervention in the country. Remember that according to the opposition line pollster data analysis, as of October of last year, nearly 57% of the population has a negative evaluation of the United States. So, of course, the armed forces, you know, has five branches, not only just the conventional Army, Navy, National Guard, but also they have, there's the militia, which is, you know, largely, which is, you know, I think has a nearly 500,000 members throughout the country. I have, Paul can correct me on that. But the, you know, there definitely is contingency plans for the event of a U.S. invasion. And, you know, obviously Venezuela will attempt to defend themselves under any circumstances. They're not going to tolerate a U.S. intervention. But of course, you know, it's very, you know, fighting the wealthiest country in the world with the, you know, the most advanced weaponry, you know, will, you know, as Panama experienced in 1989, will have absolutely catastrophic consequences for the Venezuelan people.
That's the voice of Lucas Kerner. Max Blumenthal, who's in Venezuela, has been tweeting, showing pictures of people in that square yesterday. I was retweeting it on my own Twitter handle. It's very, very impressive because huge numbers of people came out on the middle of a Sunday to stand in a long line to sign a petition defending their country's sovereignty and insisting that the U.S. stop violating it. One thing that's, I think, extremely important for people who care about social change, who care about peace, who care about self-determination, who may vigorously oppose Donald Trump's policies on a whole range of issues, don't think of the Democratic Party as a good alternative, because guess what? On this, the Democratic Party leadership seems to share Donald Trump's complete imperial agenda in Venezuela. Here's what Joe Biden wrote, again, chiming in with this fake news story about Venezuela stopping the humanitarian aid shipment. Quote, only a tyrant would prevent the delivery of food and medicine to people he claims to lead. The international community must support Juan Guaido and the National Assembly. It's time for Maduro to step aside and allow a democratic transition. The Venezuelan people deserve better. Okay, that's the Trump resistance. And Nancy Pelosi did the same thing.
The leader of the resistance.
John Bolton tweeted, I appreciate the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. So Bolton and Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Trump and Pompeo, they're all in this together. I want to play an audio clip for some of our idealistic pro-Democratic Party aficionados about what Joe Biden did in the run-up to the Iraq invasion. Let's listen to Biden's comments on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
This resolution, though still imperfect, deserves our support, and let me explain why. First, the objective is more clearly and carefully stated. The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its programs to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. President Bush did not lash out precipitously at Iraq after 9/11. He did not snub the UN or our allies. He did not dismiss new inspection regimes. He did not ignore Congress. At each pivotal moment, he has chosen a course of moderation and deliberation. And I believe he will continue to do so.
That's Joe Biden's warm embrace of war criminal George W. Bush on the eve of the U.S. invasion regime change operation in Iraq. Paul Dobson, I think it's important for people to remember that these people, meaning the Democratic Party elites, are actually no different from Trump when it comes to empire.
Certainly, we're seeing the U.S. establishment line up one behind the other to throw mud at the Maduro regime and basically throw mud at the Venezuelan democratic system. However, it is also important for your listeners to remember that, for example, when Joe Biden says that the Americans are united against Maduro, he's talking about the American establishment. We have seen an extraordinary show of support, not necessarily for Maduro, because this isn't the issue to hand, but for in support for a country's right to self-determination and sovereignty, not just from the American people, but from the peoples across the world. We've seen demonstrations, we've seen pickets outside U.S. embassies, we've seen marches, rallies, articles written. We've seen hundreds of people actually come to Venezuela in the last week or so to see for themselves what is going on. And so when the U.S. rulers talk about representing their people and uniting the country against who they call a dictator of Maduro, they're really not representing the view of the streets in the United States at all, I feel.
Yeah, I can tell you that that is true. I mean, I'm the director of the Answer Coalition. We're doing a lot of outreach in communities. People are confused about this. On March 16th, Saturday, March 16th, there's going to be a very large demonstration here in Washington under the slogan U.S. hands off Venezuela, no to the coup, no to sanctions, and no to a new war. And again, it's what Paul is saying, John. The American people don't have to decide whether they like or don't like Maduro.
Yeah,
in fact, we
right.
don't have any competency.
No,
that's up to the Venezuelan people.
It's not up to us. Exactly.
We do have competency about to determine whether we like Trump and Bolton and Pompeo and Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. Do we like the U.S. government in our name doing what they did in Iraq or what they did in Libya or what they did in Vietnam? We, the American people, are competent to speak about that. And on March 16th and in the run-up to it, there's going to be lots of demonstrations and mobilizations against the U.S.-backed coup d'etat, against the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro. We're out of time. We were joined from Venezuela by Paul Dobson, a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and also from Caracas, Venezuela, by Lucas Kerner. He is an activist and a writer for the same publication, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. If you want to find out the truth about what's going on in Venezuela, turn off CNN and go online. Go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Excellent, excellent assessment and analysis, and actually also true. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations in the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, guys, always good to start the week off with you.
Yes, likewise. We love this segment. Let's get right to it. We have different categories, privacy and the surveillance state, law enforcement issues, corporate surveillance, that includes Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, artificial intelligence and robots, 5G, the new technology. Where do you want to start, Chris?
You know, I want to start out with talking about 5G, particularly because of some moves that AT&T has been making recently. So 5G, people probably have heard about this. It's the next evolution of cell phone service. So, you know, we started out a long time ago with just regular, you know, kind of cell phone service. We went 3G and then 4G. And the next thing that's coming out is 5G. And 5G isn't just like a faster evolution, right? It's not just about the fact that the network is so much faster. So just like when we went from 3G to 4G, that, you know, we could download things and watch videos a lot more, you know, a lot more quickly, which is great. And 5G does do that. But 5G is also really about the Internet of Things. It's about connecting not just your phone to the internet, but also all of these smart devices that we get, little beacons, your whatever smart device, your cameras, even, you know, down to your refrigerator, you know, doesn't necessarily need to have a Wi-Fi connection at your home. It could be a cellular device. This is also going to be something that's used widely in cars as cars, you know, more cars are internet connected now, you know, believe that or not, for everything that that means. But there's a lot of drama in the 5G world. So recently, AT&T, you know, in that there's that little bar in the top of your phone where it says, you know, you're on 4G or LTE or 3G, right? AT&T has started replacing 4G with something called 5GE, which it says stands for 5G Evolution. Except this has nothing to do with the 5G technology standard at all. It's completely deceptive marketing on behalf of AT&T. So some phones, they've already rolled this out to. It turns out that Apple is playing along with their deceptive marketing, and in the next version of iPhone software, certain phones will actually say 5GE instead of 4G or LTE, even though this has absolutely nothing to do with the 5G technology. So AT&T wants to portray itself as being ahead in 5G in this new network, when really there is nothing to do with 5G in any of these updates. All they've done is make their 4G network a little bit faster. And this is so bad that they're actually being sued by Sprint over this. Sprint has decided not to, you know, is not saying that their technology is 5G, which is good because it's not. You know, it's kind of a baseline. A company's not lying to us, sure. But, you know, they're actually being sued, and they're defending this by saying, well, we're not saying it's 5G. We're saying it's the 5G evolution. But it's pretty clear what they're doing here. They want to be seen as the first company to 5G. The problem is the first company to 5G really for a mass rollout is going to be China's Huawei. Now, we've seen China and Huawei, particularly along with ZTE, in the crosshairs so much recently. You know, the arrest of their CFO in Canada at the behest of the U.S. Just recently, Huawei came under criticism in Poland. One of their employees there was accused of spying and actually arrested. And Huawei actually completely distanced themselves. They said, that is not who we are. That is not what our company does. And they fired that employee immediately after the accusations came out. But American telecommunications companies do not want a Chinese company. Particularly, you know, it's interesting to note Huawei is almost entirely employee owned. And they have a rotating system for CEO out of their top executives. And yes, it is a Chinese company. And so American telecommunications companies, and we should say the American security apparatus, the security state, do not want this company, this Chinese company, taking over this next leap in cellular technology.
Are we talking about just speed here? Is that what this really comes down to?
It's not just speed. No, it's there are security measures in 5G, but it's also about how many devices you can connect to it. So if you've ever gone to this happens all the time. You go to a concert and there's 5,000 people around you and your cell phone service is really bad. That's because the network is overloaded with the amount of people that are in one place, right? So if you're ever in a giant crowd of people and you notice that your cell phone service really isn't working out that well, that's because there are limits on the 4G network and older networks about how, you know, how many devices you can connect at the same time and how that bandwidth is split up. So really, you know, outside of the speed issue is actually just how 5G deals with having so many more devices connected to it. And so again, that's going to be like connecting cars on the roadway or smart devices can connect instead of going to right to your Wi-Fi from your home. They can connect right out to the internet through a cellular connection. And that's going to be really enhanced by the 5G technology.
Again, G means generation, everybody. This is for older people. John?
I didn't know that until it just came out of your mouth.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
John, you're so... Get with it, man. Well, 1G was a term that was never widely discussed, apparently, until 2G arrived. So again, we're so behind it. The second generation of cell phone transmission was 2G. It added, you know, other things to our menu, like instead of just making a phone call, you could text, right? Then 3G set the standards for most of the wireless technology. Like web browsing, email, video downloading, picture sharing. So 4G was the improvement of speed, right? It was like we're taking the things that we got from 3G, web browsing, et cetera, but just made them faster.
That's right. The primary enhancement in 4G was speed.
So 5G, I'm looking up on the internet, what is 5G? Because even the people who are writing articles about it actually don't know what the heck it is. And what Chris is telling us, it's not just about more speed. It's the Internet of Things. So like what? Like my refrigerator is talking to my car? Cars are talking to each other?
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing, right? As we move into self-driving cars, right now, self-driving cars primarily, you know, use cameras to figure out what's around them, but they could start using car-to-car connections in the future in order to say, hey, I'm in this lane, I want to get over to the lane you're in, you're behind me, let me in. You know, it's the new version of the turn signal, effectively, right?
It's the new version of replacing human beings and their brains.
Yes, that too. So, you know, that could be a really interesting application. You know, you can hook up drones to this network, you can hook up all sorts of things to this network, and you can think of all kinds of uses for them, but it's going to allow many more devices to be internet connected directly.
Yeah. What's 6G?
You know, let's get to 5G first, and then maybe we can get to 6.
I'm looking at another article called, Is 6G Coming? And again, the author doesn't know what 6G is, but says it won't be here for 10 years. Anyway, Chris Garofa, let's go on to our next story.
All right. So next up, we have talked, you know, a few times on this segment about Ron Wyden and some various bills that he wants to introduce and pass. So Ron Wyden has actually introduced a do not track bill, which sounds great. You don't want to be tracked on the internet. You say you don't want to be tracked, but there's a few issues with it. The one that struck me the most coming out of an enterprise technology background is that he says what we are essentially advocating is what the big financial service firms have to do under Sarbanes-Oxley. So Sarbanes-Oxley was a law passed in 2002 after the economic crises with MCI WorldCom and Enron and other companies that really, you know, shook the economy and shook the public's trust in banking and large companies. Except the problem was with Sarbanes-Oxley, it was a lot of work for companies to comply with various regulations that were put in place. And almost no one was prosecuted. And I believe no one or maybe one person was actually fined and no one went to jail for violating these. So for him, for Wyden to say that they're advocating for the same thing as, the same style of bill as Sarbanes-Oxley, what he's saying is no one's going to jail, no one's going to pay serious fines, no one's going to be prosecuted in a serious way, except maybe to make one or two examples out of people. So, you know, we were excited to see what came out of this. I'm not surprised to see that this bill, which has, you know, some okay ideas in it, is really going to, again, not really address the issues of privacy that we talk about.
We're speaking with Chris Garaffa, as we do every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Chris, what's next?
There have been a number of stories about iPhone apps coming out in the last week or so. And what it all comes down to is, as this story from TechCrunch says, many popular iPhone apps secretly record your screen without asking. And there's no way a user would know. So we're talking about Hollister, the clothing company. We're talking about Expedia. And we're talking about Hotels.com, Singapore Airlines app. What they're doing is when you're using the app, they are taking screenshots of what you're doing. They're not just tracking what button you tap. That's something common, right? They know what button you tap so they can see how many people are using a feature. They're actually going and taking screenshots of your screen, and they say it lets them kind of, their developers, you know, replay how you're using the app and figure out, you know, what's confusing and if there are any errors. But the problem is, most of these apps aren't masking your information. So let's say you're using the Air Canada app, and you put in your passport number and your credit card into the app, and it takes a screenshot and it sends it back to them. There's a good chance your screenshot, that screenshot contains your passport number, your credit card, your personal information. And that's not something that the app developers need to have. That's something that you need to put into the airline company, not the developer of the app. So Apple actually responded relatively quickly to this. I mean, it's curious. I'm curious to know if they knew that people were doing this ahead of time before this story broke. But Apple actually gave developers one day to remove any software or any part of their application that took screenshots without the user's knowledge. And it seems like most of the apps that were cited in this TechCrunch article have complied with that and are still on the App Store. So Apple did respond, you know, in a day to it. That's a pretty good response if they somehow didn't know it was happening ahead of time. But it just goes to show how far these advertisers and data companies are going to go to gather information about you and effectively track you via your information.
How do you react to that, John?
I kick myself because I just did that 2 weeks ago. Coming back from the UK, I used this brand new app and put all my information and sent it off. Never thought about it a second time.
Yeah.
Now I kick myself.
Is John unusual, Chris?
No, John is not unusual at all. We need to get things done, right? And so these apps let us get things done. You know, you want to book a flight. You want to get a hotel, like with Expedia or Hotels.com. You want to do all these things. You know, but the thing to keep in mind is that any app out there could be grabbing information that you're not even aware you're giving out, where, you know, we've talked about location so many times, interests, and at this point, you know, anything you search for as well in these apps. So let's say you're using hotels.com and you search for hotels in Philadelphia. Well, it has an idea that you're interested in traveling or planning a trip now to Philadelphia. combine that with all of the other signals, you might start seeing ads for Philadelphia hotels or attractions in other places in your online existence.
It happens every day.
That's how these work, right? And you know, we don't even know in some ways how these apps are getting us. I discovered just a couple weeks ago, you know, I had downloaded a game. Somebody introduced me to a game. It was fun. And it turns out that it was grabbing whatever was on my clipboard. You know, when you copy and paste, right? When you copy it, it goes onto your clipboard. I found out this app was grabbing everything on my clipboard and sending it back to the developers.
Oh.
So I put some choice phrases on my clipboard, sent them back to them, and then deleted the app and sent them an email and blasted them on Twitter. They haven't gotten back to me yet as to what they were doing.
Really something. Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk about the big issues in technology every week. John, I have to tell you that, you know, we talk about the issues of war and peace, intervention, occupations, sanctions. We do all of that all week long on Loud and Clear. We talk about education. Tomorrow we'll talk about the economy. On Wednesday we'll talk about nuclear issues. We'll talk about a lot of things that, you know, might be considered frightening to some people, right? But I think the most frightening part of our week
is the
discussion of the technology, because the reason being that we all use this technology, like you downloaded that app, because in essence you're thinking, look, this app is going to make my life a little bit easier.
Yeah, that's
and indeed right. It does. And so we think of the apps and we think of the way we're using these technologies in a benign way. This is pretty good. This is makes life more convenient. And always human beings will go to the latest in technology. I mean, we're never going back. Nobody wants to. I mean, even though I make jokes here like, isn't it time to get our flip phone back again, which I believe is we should.
Yeah.
I still don't do it, right? Because it's hard to go back. And again, we look at whatever is new, especially technology, as something benign. But in fact, these are powerful corporations and a powerful state. They have their own agenda. You could see like what Apple did. They called them out within a day. All of these apps, they know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. It's not benign.
It's not benign. And, you know, it's like trying to guess. It's like the Mueller investigation. It's trying to guess what the Mueller investigators have on any one person. It's trying to guess what these app developers have on us, trying to guess what their agenda is. And it's impossible to do that.
Yeah. The thing about it is that the technology of any era defines in many ways the era, or it redefines it. It opens up new possibilities, some good, some bad. But, you know, old style capitalism, for instance, which became the world economic system, and it really became a global system. I mean, it spread step by step all around the world. And it began with the emergence of a world market, say, 600 or 700 years ago. And step by step, the old order, feudalism or semi-feudal existence or the patriarchal village or the communal existence, whatever, capitalism basically wiped that all out. And the market sort of reshaped the image of the world in the image of the most advanced capitalist country and the most advanced capitalist technology, or the technology that was introduced by capitalism. We have a situation where we now have gone through, it seems to me, Chris, and I want to get your take on this, a transformation. The 19th century and 20th century capitalism, the capitalism of the Industrial Revolution, people came together basically in factories, in large-scale production, using the manufacturer and the assembly line to produce industrial products that were then used for the advances of science and technology. The commodity was that which human labor produced, human labor and machine labor, you know, the combination of those two. But here we have a situation where the commodity is the person themselves. This new stage of capitalism with these new technologies, maybe some people call it communicative capitalism, we are the product. It's not our labor that's creating the product. We ourselves are the product, just as we live based on our own information sharing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You know, in the industrial era, you would go to work, you know, in a factory or wherever, you would work for how, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours, and your boss, the bosses would make that profit off of you during those work hours and then also keep your living conditions poor, so you relied on that job. But now the bosses are making billions of dollars off of our basic existence, off of the fact that we are looking things up, that we have access to this global network with practically all of the information in the world, with the ability to talk to people, not just next door, but across the globe, they are monitoring and trying to capitalize on every little piece of that to make themselves more profit. So it's not even, so we are still being, you know, exploited when we work, but we are also being exploited just by existing, right? I think you're absolutely right in that. And I think it is in many ways, you know, this a new stage of information capitalism, I like to think of it, where we are the product even when we pay for these things.
Again, people should look up some of the works of Jody Dean, J-O-D-I. She's been on our show, Jody Dean. She's an academic in Western New York, but she's written a great deal about communicative capitalism. It's a very interesting assessment of this new stage, this latest stage. And again, Chris, I'm glad we're able to go at this issue based on the news of the day, the news of the week, and be able to sort of look at the stories that are happening that we're witnessing or we're observing either in print media or on the mainstream media. But a lot of times we don't really understand what's beneath the headline. So let's go on to our next story.
Well, just real quick before we go on, Brian, I just want to give a shout out to, again, to Jody Dean, who I also know. She has an article or a piece in a new book called Digital Objects, Digital Subjects, which I recommend people go check out as a fascinating collection of essays and pieces on this topic. It's Digital Objects, Digital Subjects, and it's available for free online for download. So recommend people go check that out, particularly Jody Dean's contribution. But moving on, I found this really interesting article. The article itself is pretty technical, but what it comes down to is there is a smart light bulb that connects to your Wi-Fi. It's called the LIFX light bulb, and it can, you know, turn itself on and off at certain times. It can change colors, all that kind of fun stuff. But somebody discovered that if you throw one of these out, you know, physically, somebody could actually take a hacksaw to it, remove the chips from the inside, and get your wireless password, your Wi-Fi password for your home, out of the actual chip that is inside of this, and it wasn't secured. So I'm not particularly interested in this one particular light bulb, but I bring this up to say we need to consider what we're giving away when we create a smart home and a smart, you know, a connected home, right? So we have the Ring doorbells. We have, I've seen out there, curtains and blinds that can open and close themselves depending on how bright it is. They automatically detect those things. And this stuff sounds amazing. This is the stuff that in my childhood I dreamed of having. But the reality of it is, if these companies aren't being secure, if these companies are prioritizing everything other than security, they do stupid things like this, you know, including your wife keeping your Wi-Fi password in plain text for anyone who has a little bit of technology knowledge to go get. Now, once somebody connects to your Wi-Fi at home, they can control all of your other light bulbs, right? They can control your refrigerator, your TV, your computers, your phones, all of that kind of stuff. They can start getting into those. So I bring this up. I flagged this story, not for the particular device in the story, but for the general thought about what does it mean for us to be always on and always connected? And what does it mean when we don't have security and privacy as guarantees and as things that are, you know, top of mind when these sorts of products are being developed?
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk to Chris every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day in the Washington, D.C. area at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM. Other radio stations as the evening goes on. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com. You can subscribe to us as a podcast at iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio. You can hear us at Spotify and Spreaker. Chris Garaffa, what's our next story?
Well, our next story is about Amazon. So Amazon has this, you know, of course, it has the Ring doorbell cameras. They purchased that company. But now they have a new app called Neighbors. And they say it's a, you know, it's to connect to your neighbors and people who, you know, this is for people who have the Ring doorbell or, you know, other Ring home security systems that we know have. They have these cameras that basically put a camera pointing out to the sidewalk, right? So that anyone who's coming by is getting captured on your internet connected camera, your doorbell security system or whatever. So that's not necessarily anything new. But what this app does, this Neighbors app, is it lets people talk about what they think are crimes or suspicious people that are in their neighborhood. It actually, they say they classify themselves as a new neighborhood watch. But what researchers have discovered, and not just for neighbors, but similar platforms like Nextdoor, is that it turns out that it's generally wealthier white folks who are basically using them as platforms to be entirely racist. So I've gone on Nextdoor myself and seen this in my neighborhood, and I know folks across the internet who have seen this in their own neighborhoods. But basically what the folks are doing on Neighbors is they're saying, you know, hey, there was a black person walking down the street, and people are following them from house to house with these cameras. And then in some cases, calling police and using the fact that this person was walking around, looking around as evidence, and handing over these camera images to the police as evidence of some kind of crime happening. Now, Amazon says this is for things like, you know, package theft, break-ins, and all of that. But analysis of how it's actually being used shows that it is really a way to criminalize blackness and to other people who don't necessarily fit in a neighborhood.
You know, I had a similar experience with Nextdoor. When I first heard about this app, I thought it was a terrific idea. It's a, you know, micro, geographically, it's kind of a micro app. It's just your neighborhood. And I thought it would be good to, you know, to post things like, for example, I had two pallets that I wanted to get rid of, and I put them out on the street, and whoever wanted to stop by and pick them up could have them for free. But that's not what the app turned out to be used for. The app turned out to be used for reports that a Hispanic man, and this actually happened, a Hispanic man was seen in our park at midday. There's a park in our neighborhood, and he had been seen several, you know, three times during the course of the week. Somebody called the police. Well, the guy just went to sit in the park because it was a nice day and he wanted to, you know, have lunch or whatever. It got to the point where I ended up deleting this app because it did nothing that it was supposed to do, and it was just a forum for local racists to get together and follow people.
Right. You know, neighborhood watches, you know, and racist neighborhood watches are nothing new, right? But this is just, this technology enables people to come together even more quickly and to effectively threaten the lives of people just going about their days, whether they're sitting in a park or, you know, there's one video in this article that says the video was taken and somebody posted it saying gang members are going to the roof to smoke crack. There was no proof of any of that happening. That's just what somebody saw because it was young black men wearing hoodies. Absolutely outrageous.
Unbelievable. Well, we've got just under 5 minutes left. Chris, what would you like to talk about next?
Well, let's go into an interesting article from the Wall Street Journal, some new plans that Google has for what's called augmented reality. Augmented reality can actually be very cool. You know, usually when we talk about AR, people think about, you know, putting a headset on your head and it's got, you know, the heads up display, you know, that's kind of on top of whatever you're seeing in the real world. That, you know, that works out in the movies, but it's not something that people are going to do, you know, day-to-day life, right? You're not going to put this headset on and, like, you know, walk around like that. Google tried that with their Google Glasses a few years ago, and everyone just got made fun of. But now Google Maps is going to start using something called AR mode. They're going to be testing this primarily in large cities to start out with. And then you know, just like they had Street View and everything else, it's going to come to smaller cities and smaller areas. So we used to think that Google's, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Google Maps cars. You know, they've got all these cameras on top of them and radio antennas. They really draw, you know, attention to themselves when they're going down the street. But turns out, you know, we've known for a while, they weren't just collecting information and taking photos of streets for the maps. At one point, they were collecting information on Wi-Fi networks. So what's the signal, you know, if you're in this location, the strength of all the Wi-Fi networks around you is this, and that actually helps you determine where you are. You know, that so your phone actually does that too. It can figure out, you know, if you're at home, it knows how strong your Wi-Fi signal is and knows how close to home you are based on, you know, are you in the front yard or the backyard? So the cars were doing that. The cars also have been taking these detailed pictures and scanning information like hours of operation and where a door is, you know, for a specific address. And they've been doing that, you know, with artificial intelligence. And so now what this author talks about in the test that they've done for this, you know, for this new feature is that you can basically get off the subway, put your phone up and it's going to do like an overlay on maps to show you exactly where that business is, where it is. So it's going to use your camera, but overlay on top of the camera saying, here's the entrance to that coffee shop you want to go to, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Now we need a phone to walk around the block.
That's what it's come down to.
It's full spectrum dominance over all parts of what used to be like just a normal human experience by the surveillance corporation, which again, heavily interacting with the surveillance state. Chris Graffa, we have about 90 seconds left. I actually wanted you to go over a technology tip that you gave to us a long time ago about passwords, but we don't have time for that. We'll do it next time, everybody. What's this week's technology tip?
Folks might have seen that Jeff Bezos has been in the news. Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon and Washington Post, for some illicit text messages that he sent that have apparently been leaked. We don't know all the details about how AMI got these text messages just yet, so they may have done something else. But I want to point out, it is very easy for somebody to take over your phone account and just get a SIM card, put it into another phone, and actually monitor, you know, or place calls or text messages as you. They just need your phone number and a little bit of personal information about you. Maybe the last four of your social security, your mother's maiden name, things that either you're giving out on Facebook or that are out there in data leaks. So what you can do, and this works no matter which cell phone provider you have, go on the website or call them up and say you want to add a security PIN. This is going to be a 4-to-6-digit code, and keep it private and don't use, you know, your birthday or your kid's birthday for it. But you add this code, and anytime anyone wants to make a change to your account, they also have to have this code in addition to your personal information and your password. So it's an extra step that you can take to prevent your phone from actually being your phone account and phone number from being taken over by somebody else.
We will leave it there. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Graffa. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. La 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 la